This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 4th of January, 2008. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we know that violence is escalating in Kenya, but what does it mean for humanitarian efforts in neighboring countries? Burma marks its 60th anniversary of independence, but its people say they don't yet feel free. And a record number of caucus-goers pick Obama and Huckabee in the first presidential contest in Iowa. Those stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The death toll from a car bomb that exploded Thursday in southeast Turkey has risen to 5. The blast, which occurred in the Kurdish-majority city of Diyarbakir, reportedly injured more than 100 people, some of whom remain in critical condition. Turkish authorities have blamed PKK rebels and have granted police broad powers to conduct warrantless searches of the city's buildings and vehicles. The remote-controlled car bomb exploded as a military van passed by, but most of the dead are university students from a nearby school. In other news, Georgians head to the polls tomorrow to vote in the closest presidential race in the country's history. Deborah Wild reports from Tbilisi.
7 candidates are competing for the 5-year presidential term. Among them is the former president Mikhail Saakashvili, who called for the early elections in November after imposing a state of emergency in response to major mobilizations in the capital. Saturday's elections are regarded by many in the international community as a test of Georgia's progress on the path towards democracy. International observers have already warned that the campaign in the run-up to the vote has created a highly polarized political environment with the potential to undermine the credibility of the outcome. Most opposition politicians have complained about the unequal access to media and other resources and have alleged that the vote will be rigged. They have called on the Georgian public to flood to the streets on January 6th, when official results are due to be announced. In response, the government is accusing the opposition of being more focused on post-election protests than the election itself. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Deborah Wild in Tbilisi, Georgia.
The shooting death of an indigenous Mapuche university student has sparked protests in southern Chile. The 22-year-old student was killed early Thursday morning when police moved in to eject Mapuche activists from a piece of land they had occupied. Reactions in southern Chile included road blockades and a number of fires set on disputed land claimed by both Mapuches and Chilean forestry companies. Mapuche activists on the Argentine side of the border clashed with federal police outside of the Chilean consulate in Bariloche. In other news from South America, the 3-way political battle over the fate of hostages held by Colombia's FARC guerrillas has taken a new turn today, with the administration of Colombian President Álvaro Uribe claiming that DNA results show that one of the hostages may already be in government custody. Manuel Rueda has more from Bogotá.
The hostages were originally scheduled for release a week ago. The FARC says Colombian troop movements in the area prevented the release, while President Álvaro Uribe says the FARC canceled the operation because they had lost their youngest hostage, 3-year-old Emmanuel, son of former vice presidential candidate and current FARC hostage Clara Rojas. The Colombian government claims the boy was taken to an orphanage for safekeeping almost 2 years ago because of the harsh conditions in the jungle. In a highly publicized move, the Uribe administration this week took DNA samples from the mother and brother of Clara Rojas to compare them with those of the boy it says is Emmanuel. Colombia's chief prosecutor announced today that the results indicate a very high probability that the boy in their custody is the son of Clara Rojas. But Venezuela's foreign minister has cast doubt on the credibility of the results, saying the Colombian government would not allow Venezuelan experts to perform their own DNA tests on the child. The Colombian DNA test will be sent to a Spanish laboratory that will scrutinize the results. The outcome is likely to cause another political storm between both governments. Manuel Rueda, FSRN, Bogotá.
Charges of disorderly conduct have been dropped against an Ohio woman whose videotaped arrest showed an officer repeatedly using a taser on her after she was already in handcuffs. Evan Davis has the story from Columbus.
Charges against Heidi Gill were dropped after the arresting officer Richard Kovach declined to testify against her on the advice of his attorney. Heidi Gill claims to be suffering from long-term health effects, including periodic dizziness and blurred vision, after being tasered and kicked multiple times during her arrest. Kovach was suspended pending an investigation of the incident and has since been fired for lying to investigators in an unrelated case. The police use of tasers has become controversial in Ohio. In August of 2007, a Toledo area man died in police custody after being tasered multiple times. And the FBI is currently investigating an incident in Trotwood, Ohio, where an officer applied a taser to the neck of a pregnant woman while restraining her in a police station. In May of 2006, students at a high school in Newark, Ohio, petitioned the school board to ban taser use in Newark schools after an officer tasered a 9-year-old student. In November of 2007, the UN Committee Against Torture issued a report declaring taser use to be a form of torture and called for discontinuing its use. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis reporting from Ohio.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
There's been lots of changes in the presidential race. Barack Obama and Mike Huckabee passed one major hurdle by winning in Iowa, and they won by a landslide. At the other end of the spectrum, two Democrats, Senator Chris Dodd and Joe Biden, drop out of the race. All this in the small Midwestern state whose citizens smashed voter turnout records. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports from Iowa.
The final count then results in Richardson, one delegate. Obama, three delegates.
The outcome at Precinct 2 in Clive, Iowa, a suburb of Des Moines, mirrored the results of the entire state. Obama won the most delegates, with John Edwards and Hillary Clinton practically tied for second, and Bill Richardson came in fourth. In his victory speech, an emboldened and confident Barack Obama sounded more like an inspirational speaker, a visionary, than a presidential candidate. He focused little on the issues and policies, instead enhanced his theme of unity, attempting to diminish the political divide.
Our destiny will not be written for us, but by us, by all those men and women who are not content to settle for the world as it is, who have the courage to remake the world as it should be. That is what we started here in Iowa, and that is the message we can now carry to New Hampshire and beyond, the same message we had when we were up and when we were down, the one that can change this country. Brick by brick, block by block, calloused hand by calloused hand, that together, ordinary people can do extraordinary things. Because we are not a collection of red states and blue states. We are the United States of America. And in this moment, in this election, we are ready to believe again. Thank you, Iowa.
John Edwards seemed pleased with his second-place finish, beating out what he calls the establishment candidate, Hillary Clinton. His speech sounded much like a victory speech.
What happened tonight is the Iowa caucus-goers said, we want something different. We are going to stand up. We are going to rise up. We're going to create an America that all of us believe in.
A shocked Hillary Clinton received 29% of the delegates. She downplayed her loss.
What is most important now is that as we go on with this contest, that we keep focused on the two big issues, that we answer correctly the questions that each of us has posed. How will we win in November 2008 by nominating a candidate who will be able to go the distance and who will be the best president on day one? I am ready for that contest.
Joe Biden and Chris Dodd bowed out of the race, receiving less than 1% of support. Both will return to the Senate and chair their respective committees. On the Republican side, Republican Ron Paul received an impressive 10% of the vote, beating Rudy Giuliani, and was close behind John McCain. But the winner was Mike Huckabee, who appealed to the evangelical Iowa Republican voting bloc. He won by 10 percentage points, far more than anticipated. He disrupted Mitt Romney's strategy of winning the first state, which Romney poured millions of dollars, far more than Mike Huckabee. Huckabee addressed that fundraising disparity.
Most of the pundits believe that when you're outspent at least 15 to 1, it's simply impossible to overcome that mountain of money and somehow garner the level of support that's necessary to win an election. Well, tonight we prove that American politics still is in the hands of ordinary folks like you and across this country who believe that it wasn't about who raised the most money, but who raised the greatest hopes, dreams, and aspirations for our children and their future. And tonight, I hope we will forever change the way Americans look at their political system and how we elect presidents and elected officials.
The number of participants broke new records, with nearly 350,000 people caucusing, compared to just over 200,000 in 2004. The number of people that switched party registration won't be known for several days. The number of Republican caucus participants increased, but the number of Democratic participants nearly doubled. Back in Clive Precinct, the line to become a Democrat was out the door. Jeff Carter was one of those. He is also a first-time caucus goer. He supported Edwards.
I don't know. I listen to the messages, and I think for the first time, America is really ready for a change. I don't think a lot of Americans are really happy with the way the progress of it's going. So the only thing you can do is vote with your feet. So that's what we're doing right now.
On Thursday, Peter Welch also became a Democrat. He supported Obama.
I have. In fact, my whole family has. My mother, 84 years young, said she'd never thought the day would come that she'd even think about voting as a Democrat. But she is so disgusted, so appalled at what has happened to this nation. She said, I'm probably going to cross the line. And I just, you? And she said, yep. She said, it's that bad, Peter. It's that bad that we've just reached a point where we need a change.
In a state that yields only 50 delegates among thousands to choose the nominees, the field of Democratic frontrunners has been confirmed. Barack Obama has the momentum leading into New Hampshire. As for the Republicans, Huckabee must prove his credentials beyond the Christian right. All the candidates will engage in a 5-day campaign blitz until the voters head to the polls January 8th. For Free Speech Radio News in Des Moines, Iowa, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Kenya's opposition has ruled out joining any government of national unity set up by President Kibaki and is instead calling for a transitional administration to clear the way for a rerun of the presidential election in 3 months. But in his first press conference since post-election violence erupted, President Kibaki has ruled out this option. FSRN's John Bwakali reports from Nairobi on what other options may be available.
The option of mass demonstrations was not in Nairobi today, and Uhuru Park, yesterday's would-be venue, today remained calm. A confrontation with the police had, however, been transferred to Mombasa, Kenya's second largest city. Najib Balala, a member of the opposition's leadership, led a march of thousands to another protest trolley at Tononoka Grounds, an expansive meeting venue that has often been home to political gatherings in the coastal city. It is now becoming increasingly evident that Kenya's opposition is not just a preserve of any one ethnic community, but is a cross-section of Kenyans. Kenya is now the main focus of peace efforts spearheaded by the Africa Union. John Kufuor, Ghana's president and current chair of the Africa Union, was due to arrive in Nairobi today, but he put off the trip until an unnamed date. Some of the Kenyans who feel caught in the middle of a bruising battle are those of Asian origin. Having just returned from India, Akshay, a young 23-year-old Kenyan of Asian origin, is crying for peace.
What I really want to tell Kenyans is that we are Kenyans first. Again, you're Kenyan first. So if you're not protecting what is Kenyan, then you're failing to be Kenyan. And if you purport to, you know, want to support Kenya's democracy by, you know, playing along lines that are dividing this country, then again, you're failing this country. So my words to all Kenyans is be Kenyan first.
The USA has become even more involved in the search for peace in Kenya. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, Jindai Frazer, is expected to arrive in Nairobi later today to help bring the two parties to a negotiation table. Even as the Africa Union pushes for peace It remains to be seen whether the U.S. and European Union are only interested in a seat at the negotiating table or if they have in fact brought some food of their own. Some say that the U.S. and European Union are keen on pushing the opposition and government to settle for a form of coalition government as a way of settling the presidential election impasse. It is also not clear if these two powers are looking over their shoulders to see if China will play a key role in the negotiations. Kenya has 42 ethnic communities that are grouped between three major groups of Bantu, Kushites, and Nilotes. Despite the ethnic dimensions of the unrest in Kenya, thousands of Kenyans from the different ethnic communities insist that they have lived together all these years and are not about to be torn asunder. Kimani, a Nairobi resident, called for fresh elections of a different kind.
We can't fight for peace. All we need to do is to sit down, find a solution. If it's to forget our current political leaders, go back to the ballot box and vote for independent people who really are fresh and do not support some of these things that we're seeing happening in the country, then we do that. We have a lot of people saying, you know, we need to travel to where the people are suffering. And that's a solution, but that's a short-term solution. We need to find a way we can be able to work together and live together as people from all tribes, people from all ethnic groups, people who have actually been living together for the last, 40 years. We fought for an independence for Kenya, not for an independence for some people and not for others.
Though not subscribing to the young man's version of fresh elections, the opposition continues to insist that their preferred option to end the unrest is nothing short of fresh presidential elections administered by an independent international body. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm John Bwakali, reporting from Nairobi, Kenya.
With violence continuing to escalate in Kenya over vote rigging allegations and a tight presidential election last week, the U.S. State Department is sending representatives to the country today to see what can be done to quell the crisis. Since Kenya is both a key economic partner and is strategically located as one of the allies the U.S. wants to keep in the Bush administration's so-called war on terror, some are wondering what role the U.S. will play to end the current chaos. FSRN's Karen Miller has more from Washington, D.C.
Even though the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Jedidiah Frazier, is traveling to Nairobi today, State Department officials have made it clear that solving the political unrest over alleged rigged elections in that country will be in the hands of the Kenyans. State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick.
What needs to happen is that these political leaders need to come up with a political agreement that's mutually acceptable that resolves the political crisis. They need to do this within the confines of Kenyan law, Kenyan institutions, Kenyan constitution. Ultimately, any solution that brings about an end to the political crisis and the violence is going to have to be made in Kenya. This is going to have to be something that the Kenyans resolve for themselves.
It's been 4 days since current Kenyan President Mwai Kibaki declared himself the winner in an election against opposition ruler Raila Odinga. Since then, violent clashes have ensued, and there's been a call for an independent review of the vote. But opposition leader Odinga has said he would not trust the government to complete the investigation, and President Kibaki has rejected the call for international mediation, saying the unrest is an internal Kenyan matter. From the beginning, the State Department has emphatically said that it is sending the Assistant Secretary in a non-mediation role. Michelle Gavin from the D.C.-based Council for Foreign Relations says the U.S. had to make the move since Kenya is a strong, strategically placed ally.
In some ways, this is sort of a tactical move to ensure that Assistant Secretary Frazier isn't sort of set up to be snubbed by being cast in this role of international mediator.
Gavin says many in the country want to scrap the last election and have a new one. But since the current situation is so volatile, there is a question on when and if that would happen. There's also a question on how to keep the peace until then.
It's a little frightening, frankly, and it's it's a double-edged sword. It seems to be the best way forward, but an international community that puts a lot of pressure on Kenya to hold a new election, it seems to me there's then some responsibility to try and help ensure that the situation doesn't become incredibly violent in the lead-up to that election.
Gavin says even with a new election and international intervention, average Kenyans constantly feel that they are being left out, which is how the growing unrest began in the first place.
In the eyes of many Kenyan voters, there's always an accommodation for the elites. There's always an accommodation for the political elites, but they're not so confident that there's going to be an accommodation for them.
The current political unrest has left over 300 dead and displaced thousands of others. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
The chaos in Kenya, which has largely brought transport to a halt, has already started to take its toll on neighboring countries. Thousands of people displaced by fighting in the volatile Great Lakes region in eastern Africa are at the risk of starvation because the World Food Program cannot transport vital supplies. Trucks that would normally haul food through the region have been stuck at major roadblocks in Kenya. Major relief agencies have now issued an appeal for food and drugs for those who need it the most. FSRN's Joshua Chilimpa reports.
The World Food Program says continuing violence in Kenya has blocked food aid shipments to the rest of the region, risking the lives of thousands who rely on food from the UN body. A spokesperson for the organization, Talija Shamina, says if vital supplies are not brought in sooner, the situation will worsen.
The situation on the ground is that there have been delays coming in from Mombasa, Nairobi, because of the situation right now, the riots. And the same food is going to the IDPs, the school feeding children, the programs we've been working on. This is the route we are using to give food to other areas in Congo and southern Sudan. Of course, the protection has to be there, but still our major concern is that we wait for the situation to be calm. Then we can go on with the whole process.
The supplies have been held up at the Kenyan port of Mombasa. Apart from the stranded trucks, contractors are refusing to travel without escort. The chaos in Kenya has also disrupted transport in at least five countries in the Great Lakes region. In Uganda, the price of diesel and petrol has more than doubled. Rwanda, DR Congo, Southern Sudan and Burundi are also affected. People have been lining up to refuel as pumps run dry. Winnie Bandange, Kampala resident, says she's spending up to $5 per litre for petrol.
For the last 3 days, I have had to leave my car parked at home. I have had to go to the stage and look for a boda boda and come to town. Actually, just before you asked me this question, someone just called me and gave me a tip that I can go somewhere. And they give me 30 liters of fuel at 150,000, which I think is a good deal because I don't know when the whole crisis is going to end and I cannot sit and wait in uncertainty. So I'm going to rush and get those 30 liters that will keep me going at least until when the fuel comes. That is about 5,000 shillings, more than double the price, but what to do?
Meanwhile, the World Food Program is still grappling with the issue of feeding the refugees in the region. More than 2,000 new refugees have crossed to Uganda from Western Kenya. Uganda's Minister for Disaster Preparedness, Musa Echwelu, has just read out an interagency statement of all the humanitarian agencies in which he has appealed for help with supplies of medicines.
Among the refugees are those who might have communicable infections like TB and stuff like that. Those ones have to be isolated. They should not be allowed to mix with the others who are okay. There is a bit of challenge, but which challenge we are prepared to rise to. Then when we agree on the kind of drugs, then the teams that are going to help us will be the ones to calculate how much can be mobilized. But most of them can mobilize these drugs in kind. We don't prefer to deal with money. We would prefer to deal with what we want precisely.
The World Food Program says that even some of the supplies which had left Mombasa have been held up the checkpoints and roadblocks run by vigilantes, complicating the situation even further. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Burma marks its 60th anniversary of independence from Britain today. The military government is celebrating in its new capital of Naypyidaw Da, while the opposition party holds ceremonies at their offices. But the people of Burma say that they're not feeling the true freedom of independence today. FSRN's Ronald Aung Nang has more.
Burma gained her independence in 1948.
After enjoying just more than 10 years of democracy, the military led by General Ne Win took power, saying to prevent the nation from separatists. Since then, people of Burma have been trying to topple the military regimes in several occasions. The last attempt fighting for freedom was last September, when hundreds of thousands of people got on the streets, extraordinarily led by Buddhist monks. People and monks asked the generals enter into dialogue with opposition democracy icon Aung San Suu Kyi. Aung Wei is a poet and activist who took part in the September uprising. He recently arrived at the Thai-Burma border after fleeing arrest by military intelligence.
I feel like we had lost independence. The uprising led by students in 1988 and recent uprising led by monks in 2007 are the struggles for the second independence.
With mounting pressure from United States and European countries, the military had appointed a minister to liaise between them and Aung San Suu Kyi, who has been under house arrest for more than 10 of last 16 years. There were three subsequent meetings between Aung San Suu Kyi and liaising minister Woo Aung-chi until mid-November last year. But Aung San Suu Kyi's party, National League for Democracy, says there has been no progress since then. Nyan Nguyen is a spokesperson from NLD.
Since November 19th, we haven't seen any development. We, the NLD, are absolutely not satisfied. We are worried about the process for dialogue and national reconciliation.
Instead of negotiation and dialogue, the continued arrest of the activists who took part in the September uprising is going on. Day 9 is the General Secretary of Assistance Association for Political Prisoners, Burma. They have monitored the arrest on political activists.
The junta keeps arresting people on their wanted list. On January 2nd and 3rd, 8 people who participated in the protest were arrested. One woman who was seen on video footage crying against the brutality of the soldiers was arrested last night. Altogether, there have been more than 700 people arrested so far.
In yet another disturbing report, a United Nations document released in December of last year stated that UN envoy Paulo Sergio Pinheiro was banned from the Yewis crematorium in Rangoon. Pinheiro said he received reports that large numbers of bodies had been incinerated during the early morning hours of September 27th through 30th. Since the uprising, some people fled to border, and some are still in hiding. Most of the student leaders and monks who led the September demonstrations are still under detention. On the New Year Eve, military government of Burma increased on the annual fee for satellite TV discs by then 160-fold. The discs are the only source of independent news to Burmese people. The Burma's democracy icon Aung San Suu Kyi said there is no independence without democracy in her speech during the northern trip just before attacked and arrested by military.
What I mean is, the democracy system is the only one suitable for an independent country. Only democracy can assure the freedom of the people. Only when people have freedom, the country can be said to be independent.
For FSRN, I'm Ronald Aunai in Chiang Mai.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Abogado.